Here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
People always tell me, you should have your money working for you. Because you send your money out there working for you, a lot of times it gets fired. You go back there, what happened? I had my money, it was here, it was working for me. Yeah, I remember your money. We had to let him go.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Super Terrific Happy Hour. Joining me, as always, whenever the world is super and terrific, it normally means that Steph Pomeroy's around, because that makes me happy. So, Steph, how are you?
Well, it's super and terrific to be with you. Thank you for arranging this. This is great. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Well, I think that's a little deflective, because you arranged most of it.
Well.
you did most of the arranging. I did a little bit here and there, but most of it was you.
You did the heavy lifting. You handled all of the technology aspect of this, and that's good, because if I were in charge of that, no one would be hearing this recording right now.
Well, see, this is why I don't explain to you just how easy that is, because then you'll drop me like a bad habit.
Well, listen, I'm just so impressed.
When you talked about arranging, we should probably let people know exactly what it is we've arranged, because we have an inflation panel, I guess. Should we call it a panel, Steph, or is that a bit too highfalutin? What do you reckon?
No, I think panel is a good word.
That's inflation
politically
panel.
Correct, isn't it? There's no one. We're not offending anyone with panel.
I think we're appropriating the wood industry in any way, shape, or form. So I think we're okay. But we have joining us three fantastic guests: Dave Ivan of Copenhagen Global, Adam Rosenzweig of Goring and Rosenzweig, and James Davolos of Horizon Kinetics. And we are going to discuss the subject of inflation with all three of them. You know, they've all done some phenomenal work, Steph, on the subject, whether it be inflation as an idea, but more importantly, for this conversation in particular, what to do about it and what stocks to look at and how the commodities complex plays into that.
I'm really looking forward to it, especially given what's going on in the markets right now. I have a feeling that what we're going to hear here is going to be very different from what you're hearing on CNBC this moment.
Of that, I have no doubt. Well, why don't we find out and bring the guys in?
Let's do that.
Well, welcome, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. We're extremely grateful that the three of you could find time in your schedules to kick around this whole idea of inflation. James, Adam, Dave, Steph and I have kind of explained at the top of the show what we're going to try and do. So I think the easiest thing to do is just kind of to jump straight into the conversation. And I think, James, I think you're going to lead us off. Is that correct?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right, my friend, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so I think kind of when looking at our macro outlook, it behooves us to also look at where we've been wrong. And, you know, we were part of the crowd that thought something was going to break well before over 5% on Fed funds. Like maybe we thought maybe around a 3% range. I guess we were wrong that they did get to as high as they've gotten to. Something did break. So Silicon Valley and First Republic and the others went under when Fed funds was around 4.5%. But the resilience of the economy has been remarkable and I think astonishing to almost all of the observers. And taking a step back and looking at where the assumptions were, I think the biggest thing that keeps coming back to us, forget the fact that there's a lag in interest rates and forget the fact that there's kind of all these nuances to monetary policy, it's kind of the fiscal dominance and how that has really put a lot of resilience into the economy. So by the end of this year, we'll have about $6 trillion of cumulative deficits, which has funded a lot of growth into the economy, both directly and indirectly. But the problem is the Congressional Budget Office believes that that's going to result in over $1 trillion of annual interest expense by 2028. And these very sanguine assumptions also assume zero recession and continued deficits between about $800 billion and a little over $1 trillion for the next decade. So we continue to believe that kind of the only way out of this current mess is going to be nominal growth in excess of the cost of debt service for the federal government, because otherwise the problem just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and the potential breaking point gets bigger and bigger. the only two ways to theoretically fix this would be austerity or a default. Let's take those off the table for a variety of reasons, not the least of which, you know, the cure would kill the patient and, you know, kind of we've just gone too far here. So we think that the end game here is going to be either an implicit, more likely, or an explicit, probably not under the current chair of the Fed, target of inflation above 2%, probably above 3%. The outcome is going to be structural, volatile inflation, higher but volatile interest rates. And the investment conclusion, which we're going to get into later, is going to be you really want to own a variety of real assets.
I guess, Adam, you're next at the tee box.
Well, thank you. And it's wonderful to be here and talking with you all today. And thank you for arranging all this. You know, we are natural resource investors. And so we look at things clearly through our own lens and through our own outlooks and views. And what we see from a macro perspective going forward is a real inflection point and a period of much, much higher commodity prices. And the reason for that is as simple as it is complex. It's that we're going through a massive commodity cycle. And if you look back over the last 120 years, and that's how long we have pretty good data for, you see that commodities move in these big, big, big cyclical waves. And typically what ends up happening is you'll have a period of time where commodity prices are high, companies generate really good supernormal profits, it attracts investor capital in, you know, everyone is just about as bullish as can be. And it doesn't, you don't need a super long memory to go back to the middle part of the early 2000s when, you know, everyone was talking about the latest and greatest Canadian oil sands project or the latest and greatest shale deposit or even, you know, gold and copper mines around the world. And certainly we remember some major busts and blowups through that sector as well. Money pours in, it chases new supply, and eventually all that supply comes online. It overwhelms the market, prices collapse. Investors who have underwritten projects at higher prices pour their money back out. Everyone talks about how an industry is dead and uninvestable. Ideally, even maybe Time Magazine or Business Week or somebody or Forbes writes a cover story about it. That's how you know the bottom's close. And you reset the new cycle. And this cycle that we've been in now basically topped out in 2010 and has been in a grinding, grueling bear market ever since. It's seen capital spending across the board cut 70-80%. It's seen huge diversions of energy and capital into what I would call really unproductive assets, which to me, the most unproductive are probably intermittent wind and solar, things of that nature. Cheap energy and cheap capital has allowed the huge proliferation of those technologies. And slowly but surely, we've been ratcheting this whole market tighter and tighter and tighter. And I think now we're finally at this point where supply is beginning to really slow down. Certainly growth has slowed down across most industries. Demand remains extremely robust for all the talk of traditional energy demand. It has never been more robust, frankly, than it is right now. And we're in the process of moving from a period of surplus into a period of deficit. And what does that mean? It means that commodity prices are going to move a lot higher. That's going to be true across the board. It's probably going to be the most true where you've seen the most starvation of capital, and that's in your traditional energy, your oil and your gas as well. But it's going to be true in copper. It's going to be true in uranium mining, where, you know, you saw a 90% peak to trough fall in the price of uranium. So I think you're seeing it across the board. Energy has gone from being about 15% of the S&P down to a low of 2% a couple years ago. It hasn't been able to break 5%. You know, energy has been the best performing sector now for going on 3 years in the market. And you've seen persistent selling by all the generalists out of the XLE, out of the XOP. It doesn't matter. So, you know, I think that this bear market is run its course. I think you're in a sustained bull market move now, but asset allocators still haven't woken up. And what that means is that the snapback is going to be more pronounced and last longer. And unfortunately for people having to deal with inflation, I think you're going to have a tough time with higher raw material prices for the better part of the decade.
Dave, why don't we flip it over to you and give us your quick macro view.
Okay, thank you. And thanks to Grant and Stephanie for putting this on. I think it's very timely. As Adam said, I think we have three firms here that all look through our own unique lens, come up with similar conclusions, yet unique solutions. So I think it's a good time for this. We are 100% bottom up, but I'm happy to share the macro views because usually as a bottom-up investor, what we like flies in the face of the top-down macro story, or here's one of these fortuitous times where they line up together. The cheap stocks are also the beneficiaries of a lot of top-down trends that we're talking about. So a very bifurcated market, even more so than in 1999. They pay up for things they love, and they are giving away things that are very cheap. A lot of the things that are cheap are beneficiaries from any inflationary trends. And it's kind of interesting to see people give up on the concept of inflation. We think Milton Friedman had it right, that it's always a monetary phenomena. So people will say, no, it's about demographics, or it's about the strength of the economy. You look around at economies around the world that are floundering, you know, Argentina, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, they do not have low inflation. So we think people have that wrong. If it is a monetary phenomena, the money supply is up tenfold since 2008, tenfold. And that's after the $1 trillion drawback they've just had. So as we'll talk later when we get to the investments, that $10 trillion is already migrating through the system. But maybe that'll stop. As you've already heard before, it's highly unlikely it's going to stop. Democracies don't have a tendency for supporting austerity. And I'm not aware of any major politician in any country on the world now that is actually arguing for austerity. So I think that's something that's highly unlikely to happen. History and logic suggest that we're going to see a continuation of what we've seen. If there's even a chance I'm right, people ought to have at least some part of their portfolio allocated to real assets and inflation beneficiaries. And from where they're priced, we think the upside to their downside is very compelling.
There's definitely a whole bunch of common threads there, which is going to make the various ways you guys are going to tackle this incredibly fun to discuss about. So James, why don't we bring it back to you and talk about how you guys at Horizon are looking to navigate this and your ideas around how investors should think about it.
Sure. So, you know, I started off with more of a top-down view, but we're also almost exclusively bottom-up. But I think that unfortunately in the current environment, you need to have a top-down view. Otherwise, you're kind of flying blind here. But fundamentally, looking at the supply side, we continue to believe that natural resources are one of the most compelling investment opportunities. And a lot of it just comes down to the fact that not only has capital been starved from these industries for, in some cases, decades, but there's very little incentive and there's a lot of political pushback to actually do the right things to balance the market longer term. But then that's also coupled with the fact that we have fairly resilient demand. And I think what a lot of the kind of the heuristic approach, especially with regards to energy consumption, looks at is efficiencies and electric vehicles in the OECD world. But the real delta here is the non-OECD world, where, okay, China has its problems today, but then you've got a couple billion people in India, Indonesia, Africa, Central South America, where that's where the real growth is going to be. And the other big problem is that we've basically spent 30 years importing disinflation in the form of cheap, abundant resources and cheap, abundant labor. A lot of that has been exhausted, and now we're competing with those same countries in order to access the same labor and materials. So we think the most pronounced area is going to be in energy, because we think that demand is going to continue to grow for much longer than most of the international agencies and experts think, and then also plateau for a very long time after that. So in that scenario, the current capital expenditures just simply don't get you to where you need to be under any variety of scenarios. But one of the problems with investing in energy companies is kind of the capital intensity. So yes, there are one-off examples of very capital efficient companies, especially major integrated companies that have a lot of integration with downstream and midstream and different types of value-added activities. But you're kind of pure play drillers. It's a tough business. You have high lifting costs, you have high cost of capital, you have rising reinvestment costs and reinvestment risks because the grades of resource are declining. So our preferred modality to express a long-term structural view in energy is royalties. And that's one of the pillars of our real asset fund, the inflation beneficiaries, which at the end of the day, it's really a real asset fund with our unique take on capital light inflation beneficiary real asset companies. You know, in theory, all real assets do benefit to some extent from inflation, but those that benefit the most are those that can control the cost line. So it's fairly easy for all real assets to benefit on the top line, but if you can't control the cost line, you and your investors might not be all that much better for better off from that environment. So at a very high level, again, royalties are basically, instead of doing the exploration, the drilling, the transportation, the refining, you're simply taking a revenue interest off of the driller's activities. So again, ultra simplistic, if Chevron or Occidental is going to spend billions of dollars developing your land, you get a revenue, you have an interest on gross revenue. So they could be producing at, let's say it's $100 barrel oil, but their break even is 90. It's not, but I'm just giving you a hypothetical example. You benefit from the nominal price appreciation regardless of their net benefits. So what that creates is an extremely high operating margin, even at the bottom or middle of the cycle, you know, 70% plus. And then almost all of that gets converted down into after-tax free cash flow. You would think that these businesses would be extremely richly valued. And in fact, in the private market, you're seeing very, very high multiples being paid for smaller digestible size royalty packages. So things in the range of, let's say, very low, so millions of dollars, all the way up to maybe 100 to 200 million. But there's really no scale to buy the really large packages. And this is evidenced by one of our top picks in the US, Viper Energy Partners. So Viper is a subsidiary of sorts of Diamondback Energy. They have some of the best royalty acreage in the United States, focused in tier one acreage in the Permian Basin. They just did a deal where they bought about $1 billion package in the Permian at a 15% unlevered free cash flow yield, which you're only paying for producing wells, drilled but uncompleted wells, and permits. So that 15% is at strip, and strip prices are backwardated. Then you have all of that upside from exploration at a 15% steady state yield at strip. The reason why that exists is there's only one or two players out there that could even bid for $1 billion package. Viper got the deal because they were able to actually go in at about a quarter cash. So again, looking kind of a look through into Viper at the parent level, at $90 oil, you're buying this company again at a steady state 15% distributable cash flow yield. They pay out about 75%, so you're getting at about 11% yield with 25% retained to reinvest and grow. And you're not paying for any of that optionality on the tail. So this is why we really love royalties, is if they have 30 plus years of production, which they do, there's a tail there, which if you were to do a Black-Scholes model on 30 years of oil and gas revenue with effectively zero cost, that would break the Black-Scholes machine. It would be many, many multiples of the entire aggregate market value of royalties in the marketplace. Another interesting item with Viper, because of, unfortunately, the market structure that we're in, they were a partnership where they could basically pass through taxes. But when we reduced the corporate tax rate to 21%, they elected in a check-the-box election to basically convert into a taxable partnership. In the eyes of Standard & Poor's and MSCI, in their infinite wisdom, that is not eligible for index inclusion, even though it's effectively taxed as a corporation. They're converting to a corporation for precisely that purpose and will be eligible for index inclusion once that's completed. Again, adding kind of this robo bid because they basically have zero representation today because of the limited partnership structure. One other name in kind of energy royalties, if you don't want to have exposure to U.S. shales, is Prairie Sky in Canada. So Prairie Sky has almost 20 million acres, mostly in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. And a lot of people think about Canada, think of this thick, viscous, heavy oil sand. They do have some exposure to that, but if you drill down into the Canadian energy market today, their conventional production, which is basically the equivalent of our horizontal fracking, is growing with incredibly low break-evens and incredibly value kind of middle-grade crudes. So again, you have this really long tail option for Prairie Sky where, you know, a fraction of a fraction of their 20 million acres are developed. But forget production growth, which I think there is embedded very strong growth with zero expense paid by you as a shareholder. Right now, they're earning incredibly low realizations on their oil, which is basically Edmonton Light. That's not as bad as Western Canadian Select, but you can't get this really valuable mid-grade crude out of the country due to pipeline and export restrictions. There's also AECO Gas, which trades at a huge discount to Henry Hub and certainly LNG contracts internationally in Rotterdam and Asia. To the extent that there's any type of environment where they can access international prices, and we are seeing more LNG export and some pragmatism on that standpoint, you have kind of an embedded uplift to the extent that they can realize better differentials over the fullness of time. But we like the company solely based off of the fact that you have this really long tail, could be over a century of inventory based on that very low developed 20 million acres. And again, I think the market just doesn't appreciate the nuance of the royalty business model. People want nothing to do with Canada. So many reasons why this is underowned and unloved in addition to Viper. But, you know, energy in general just comes out as very cheap with a lot of drivers that would correlate to this new world that it seems like we're all in agreement. We're entering a new economic paradigm where what worked for the past 30 years probably or almost can't work going forward, yet people have little to no exposure to the things that you actually do want to own.
Phenomenal. That's great, James. Thank you very much. We'll keep sticking to this topic. I've got a bunch of questions on that too. We could be here all night. Adam, let's flip it over to you.
Sure. No, thanks. You know, one thing, I know we're trying to keep to the schedule and now you want to hear sort of some of how we position ourselves, but I'm going to tell you something else before I get into that because...
Hey, you can go wherever you like. Well, the schedule is the schedule, but Steph and I don't really care. We just want to talk to you.
Right. It's not quite live TV, but basically, you know, I have the mic, so let me go. You know, one of the things that we found that was really interesting, and I think it ties together what Dave was talking about before as well, you know, when we're talking about some of the larger macro problems here in terms of, you know, fiscal dominance, as James was talking about, in terms of servicing the debt and all this money that's been printed and this Friedmanite, you know, approach to monetary systems. One of the really keen observations we made looking back again over about 150 years, when commodities and real assets, as measured just by a simple commodity index relative to the Dow, right? So you have commodity prices, you have stock prices, just divide one by the other. When they get really, really, really cheap, like they did in the late 20s, the late 60s, the late 90s, and then again right now, when you're coming out the bottom of a period where you hit the record low, every one of those times, for whatever reason, and I think we can talk about the reasons we think it might be, you saw a shift in the global monetary system. You know, throughout the 1920s, Britain tried desperately to go back on the gold standard, the pre-World War I classical gold standard. They finally gave up in 29 when Benjamin Strong died in the Fed. In 1968, everyone thinks it was 1971 that Nixon took us off gold in the U.S. It was actually 1968, and Johnson is the one who removed the gold backing of the dollar. You know, of course, the day you remove the gold backing, it doesn't mean you have no gold left. It just means that that's the day that effectively the gold standard, the Bretton Woods standard, ended. And by 71, we could no longer redeem those exchanges. So we closed the window, and that marked the bottom of resources there too. And 99 is one that goes talked about less, but Russell Napier talks often about how, you know, you have this sort of no name system where basically all the Asian currencies pegged themselves to the dollar through the 1990s, hoping that if there was a crisis, the IMF and the US would come and bail them out. That didn't happen, obviously, with the Asian currency crisis. And then all of a sudden they said, well, to hell with this. We're just going to peg it at a undervalued rate, and trillions of dollars wound up flowing over to China and other Asian countries. So, you know, I think that this idea of fiscal dominance and debt servicing problems and just monetary disequilibrium at the highest level actually is very commonly associated with these periods of real asset dislocations. And so that doesn't surprise me. And I think, you know, while I never want to sort of bet against the US and the US reserve currency status and stuff like that, you know, to me, you're primed for something like a bit of a disruption or a bit of a shock. And so it remains to be seen, but I would follow all this BRICS currency block stuff very, very closely, because we're in the right moment in history for a bit of a shift in the global monetary system. So with that, how do you play it? One of our highest conviction themes and ideas is U.S. natural gas. And, you know, right now, just to give everybody a bit of a perspective, our kind of core themes are U.S. gas, oil, and uranium. Those are our three, you know, biggest thematic longs. And then we have sort of half-weight positions in copper, gold, and then small positions in fertilizer companies and a little bit of coal as well. We're long only, so nothing on the short side. But I'll focus today on U.S. natural gas. And what I think is so interesting about U.S. natural gas is that it is far and away the cheapest molecule of energy on planet Earth, bar none. And so if you look, you know, the rule of thumb from an energy equivalent basis is 6 to 1 gas to oil. So right now, you know, oil's trading up through $90. It's having a weak day today, but basically, you know, looks like it's on its way through 100 again for the first time this year. And U.S. natural gas still has a 2 handle on it. It's below $3, $2.85. Multiply that by 6, you know, you're talking about $16, $17 oil equivalent. So you have not seen any of the move in U.S. natural gas. And that dislocation has persisted now for almost a decade. So this is not like it's, you know, a trade that has to go away. We've persisted at this for a long time. And the reason, of course, is the U.S. shales. We've brought on so much gas in the U.S. that if you're a producer up in the Marcellus, or even in Canada for that matter, you know, it's all one big kind of gas island here, you can't reach the export market. You can't reach the global seaborne price of $10 to $15 today, as high as $100 last year when Russia was really getting going in the Ukraine. So why can't you access that price? We have more gas domestically than we can run through the LNG export infrastructure. And that has kept a lid on U.S. prices. And, you know, we were talking to a family office in Saudi a couple weeks ago, and we said to them, you know, how much does it cost when you fill up your car at the gas station? It would cost us $15. Are you aware that you're getting subsidized gasoline? Said, of course, we have this huge domestic supply. We get really subsidized gasoline. Ask 100 Americans how many people realize that they have the cheapest natural gas, the cheapest energy in the world by 80%. None of them have any idea. And, you know, we consume, if you look at on an energy equivalent basis, our gas demand, natural gas demand, and our crude oil demand in the United States, it's about, you know, 60% oil, 40% natural gas. So it's a big, big, big hunk. This is not like a small niche input that we use. We use this every day in all facets of life. And we think that that dislocation after 10 or 15 years is about to end. And why do we think that? Well, we're bringing on a huge slug of new LNG export to try to be able to access that global market. 6 BCF a day within the next 18 months. And the question is, are we going to be able to grow gas supply to meet it? And I think the answer would really surprise you if we said, you know, how much has dry gas supply grown in the U.S. in the last 12 months? We need, on a base of 92, 93 BCF, or maybe a little higher now, BCF a day, we need 6 incremental Bs. So, you know, 6%, call it 7%. How much have we grown in the last 12 months? The answer is zero. We hit 100 Bs or 100 and change Bs on a dry gas basis about 14 months ago, and we are at that same level today. Now, some people say it's because of pipeline takeaway capacity issues in the Marcellus, and that as soon as you can get a pipe in place, growth will just surge again. I'm not so sure. If you look at each well that they're drilling in the Marcellus, they're slightly less productive than the one that came before it. And so, you know, to me, that's not the sign of a basin that is under infrastructure bottlenecks. To me, that's the sign of a basin that's going through a little bit of a midlife crisis and going through a plateau phase. And so I think that, you know, if you think of any commodity or any market in the world right now, in the real asset world, the ability for it to move up five or sixfold in the next couple of years, I think you're probably really only looking at natural gas, maybe uranium. You know, I don't think oil can go from $90 to $400 a barrel. I think you're really going to put a massive, massive air brake on the world economy. But could U.S. natural gas go from $2.80 up to $10 or $12? And that would just put it in line with the rest of the world. There'd be no competitive disadvantage or anything like that. You might get export restrictions by the administration, and that's something else to discuss and think about. But you know, I think that you could see a significantly higher price. Meanwhile, you know, our preferred way to play that is a company like Range Resources, and Range is a company that has what we think is the best remaining asset base in the Marcellus. I think we've become fixated on looking at asset quality and remaining inventory, because it used to be just a couple of years ago that production growth was enough to get a bid under these stocks. That's obviously long gone. You know, dollars per acre, probably from a decade ago, no one remembers that. Now I think you're developing a scarcity issue with these companies. And I think investors are going to be forced to realize that some companies have high quality remaining acreage and others don't. And James was talking about high multiples that are being paid in the private royalty markets. And what's super interesting, we have a portfolio of some private royalties at our firm as well. And so we see that market and we see where it's transacting. And I think in some ways that maybe not always, but certainly now has become the smart money. These are insiders that are operating, you know, in West Texas or where have you. And they understand the trends that are developing in the industry. And in the last 6 months, we have seen a huge scarcity bid put under assets that have remaining undrilled locations, like in some cases approaching, you know, almost unreasonable. And I think it's because people are beginning to realize that a nice acreage parcel that has 10, 15 years of tier one drilling inventory is almost an impossibility now to find. It's becoming harder and harder and harder. And one of the few exceptions, I mean, obviously I'm talking my book, but we wouldn't have the investment if we didn't think so. One of the exceptions would be a company like Range. You know, they have about 450,000 net acres in the core of the Marcellus, the liquids-rich part of the Marcellus in the Southwest. They have some of the lowest operating costs, the lowest finding and development costs. They were a perennial hedge fund short favorite. And part of the reason for that was that they made a really ill-advised acquisition back in 2016. They bought a company called Memorial Resources to try to diversify out of the Marcellus for some asinine reason. I think they had the hedge funds chirping in their ears all the time that they always had these infrastructure basis differentials coming out of the Marcellus. They said, well, why don't you buy something in the Permian? They made this really expensive acquisition, did not pan out. Luckily, we didn't own it through some of those worst days, but you know, at a certain point in 2018, they were up to like four turns of leverage after they debt financed the thing. That's all been worked off. The management team is largely new. They're not the same guys that did that. Which is a shame, because the old management team was a capable team as well, but you know, they made a really bad call there, and so you know, out they went. But now they're less than like a turn of leverage on them. They're trading at, you know, 3, 4, 5 times free cash flow, depending on what gas price. I'm not talking about using my $12-$15 gas price long term assumptions. Even sort of at the strip, you're talking about, you know, less than 4 times cash flow. So the stock has run. It made a low of $2 back in 2020. It's $10 today, but very easily, even at the strip, you're talking about a $35 price target. And if you get a good, strong bull move in natural gas, you know, the stock could be $100 easily. So, you know, I think that there's strong upside potential available in the name. And it's something that's rare and rare. It's a company with good, undeveloped tier one assets in a commodity market that could re-rate 4 or 5 fold.
Perfect. Thanks, Adam. All right, Dave, last man up.
All right. Sounds good. I mean, probably not surprisingly, we agree with about everything that's been said so far, but we do have some thoughts that can hopefully augment it. So, you know, what we've been doing for the last few years is boring our clients with a story about a guy from 300 years ago named Richard Kenelon, who he was working with John Law during the whole Mississippi scheme. He saw what money printing could do back then, but he came up with something known as the Kenelon effect, essentially saying money is non-neutral. So we talk about Friedman saying, if you print money, it causes inflation. Kenelon saying, yeah, it causes inflation, but it's not that simple. He has this analogy that if you double the amount of water, let's say in the Mississippi up in Minnesota, people in New Orleans would have no idea what's happened. And as the money came surging down, it would go over the banks on one side, but not on the other. It would do it in waves and fits and starts. And it would get to St. Louis one time and get down to another city later and get down to New Orleans much later. And so we think that's instructive. History shows when you print a boatload of money, it tends to go into the bond market, especially when they're directly buying the bonds, as they so often do. The way we calculate inflation, that's not in the CPI. People say no inflation. And then the lower bonds entices people to go into the stock market and into real estate and to other things. And then they run up. That's also not inflation. That's a bull market. Over time, if the price of houses are up a lot, people start building more houses. And so then the price of lumber and copper goes up. And when they go up, eventually the wages of carpenters goes up, and it starts to migrate through the system, and it does it unevenly. And so I think when people believe inflation is over, what they're really saying is the inflation is migrating through the system. So different points. One is that volatility is not risk, it's our friend. And as water comes zipping up and down, we've seen in recent years how the price of oil can go up and then down and then up and then down. And recently with uranium, it had that big surge, then it fell last year, and now it's heading back up to highs, although nowhere near the highs of 15 years back. But these have created opportunities to buy and sell. Looking at a lot of things you've heard about, the supply and the demand. Yeah, as this money transitions through the system, we don't know for sure where it's going to go, but with fairly good likelihood, we can assume that things that are valuable and things that are needed and things that are scarce will likely be the things that go up. People seem to like electricity and energy and metals for their EVs and windmills and things like that. So we believe that, as you've heard, the case for uranium and natural gas and copper and other things are, it's pretty compelling case. So we agree with all that. We also agree with Range, one of our big holdings for a long time. And we actually thank both of our colleagues here back in 2003 when we were maxing out on energy and trying to do little videos and things to keep our clients calm while we were buying energy when everybody knew it was going away. We drew on the research of both these firms, and it was very helpful. So thank you. We also agree with the idea of asset light royalties being a good way to go. We own a good degree of royalty firms and also have some private royalty. So we have no problem with that. We would suggest that royalties have done fine. We agree there's a lot of upside. Left in the dust is the higher cost, higher optionality things. You know, if this inflation is going to migrate through the system and lead to higher prices of copper and uranium and gold, maybe people should consider putting part of their money in some of these asset heavy things. Certainly, I agree that a lot of the costs are going to come through and hurt us, but a lot of the costs are fixed. You know, you already own the resources in the ground. And so, yeah, we've liked owning the higher optionality ones like Range that had longer reserves, and some of the smaller uranium companies have done very well. We still like them. The smaller gold companies have been left in the dust. And that we think is an opportunity. Nobody likes them. Yeah, as a off-funded tangent, in 1999, everybody kept telling me, wow, we're worried your portfolio is so risky. And I said, well, why is it risky? And they said, well, because they're small caps. And I said, well, big companies, small caps. They're small caps because the stocks have gone down so much. And now we're telling the same thing. We own some of the biggest reserves, some of the biggest undeveloped reserves in the world that have small caps. We think that's not risky. We think that is opportunity. And so let's say, let's use gold because we think that's the cheapest, but most of what I say will apply to almost all commodities right now. They have not kept up with the amount of money printing. So possibly that money migrates in, as Cantillon suggested, and eventually gets into that. We've heard also that the supply-demand story bodes well for these commodities, even without the money. So got fundamentals leading the commodities higher. You got money supply leading the commodities higher. We're happy to own these commodities. However, if the price of gold has gone nowhere while the money supply has doubled, and the gold stocks have fallen in half over the last 10 years. Some of that's deserved, but is all that deserved? So maybe there's a good opportunity there. But as they say, when people have a different opinion than you, you want to understand why. Why are these things so cheap? Why are gold stocks cheaper than gold? And why are the small, large resource things even cheaper than the larger ones? It's interesting. We go to the BMO conference in South Florida every year. It's interesting to see all these gold companies and say, what price are you using for gold? They say $1,400. Now, granted, gold's just fallen from 2000 to 1800, like it seems to like to do all the time. But it's been a long time since it's been 1400. Barrick was using 1200. I think they raised to 1300. You've heard already about shortages of supply. Well, if you're using 1400 gold, no one's going to build a gold mine, and you'll notice nobody has, not counting some small ones. So no supply coming on. We think that's pretty interesting. But in addition to this, this is the key. Yeah, we think people are completely misapplying DCF models. So when you talk to miners, you say, what do you want? Any resource company. We want, as you've already heard, big, long life reserves. If people aren't finding reserves anymore, you want to already own them. So that's what you want to own. If you're talking drugs and clothes and consumer goods and anything, you ask analysts, what are you assuming? Well, we're assuming prices go up 5% a year, plus or minus. Great. Every industry. What about commodities? Well, we're assuming the price drops 5% a year. And like, why is that? Oh, we're using a DCF. Yeah. So if gold's worth 1400 today, if you pull it out of the mine a year from now, you got to multiply that by 0.95. So the price of gold is falling versus dollars. But the whole point of DCF is dollars fall against goods and services. So they've got the model flipped upside down, which is the beautiful thing, because the longer life the reserve, the better. The longer life the reserve, the less it is worth on the models people are using. And so they are basically saying, if you're not going to pull it out of the ground for the next 5 years, it is not worth pulling out of the ground. They don't DCF the cost of pulling it out of the ground. And so, like all the other stocks you've heard about, but we think some of these uranium, gas, silver, gold companies that have lots and lots of resources, but they don't have a mine, they think they're worth nothing. We heard earlier about Black Scholes. If instead of using a DCF and saying gold's going to lose 5% a year, you say, what's the chance gold goes above 2000. The chance that it does that this week or nil. This year, maybe not. This 5 years, probably. 10 years from now, it's almost inconceivable it doesn't. So DCF model says it's worth less every year. A Black-Scholes model says it's worth a lot more every year. On a 20-year basis, we're finding the difference between you lose 73% of your money versus it goes up seven times with the length of the option. So we like high optionality. And so, we like the ranges of the world on the gas side. We like the little fissions and things like that in the uranium side. And in gold, we like things like Seabridge or things that don't have a mine. People that really like risk. Northern Dynasty in Alaska, the Biden administration is trying to make for sure it doesn't get built. So maybe it won't. But we're talking about $100 billion worth of metal that's selling for $100 million. Lots and lots of upside. So if we can have a diversified portfolio of that kind of upside, that's what we find really exciting. And last thought, I'm one of the few here that's old enough to remember the 70s, but the 70s was the last time you had an environment like this, guns and money policy and a loose Fed and worldwide turmoil and things like that. And owning optionality on oil and gold and agriculture and those things is exactly what you wanted to do then. We think we're there again.
That was awesome. Like you referenced, Dave, here we've got gold down to 1830. The last week has been absolutely brutal. And in the meantime, every day you see headlines about other central banks buying more gold. And then there was a story in the New York Post this week about Costco has 1 ounce gold bars, but they can't keep them in stock because they're going so quickly. So there's this divergence, which we are all very acquainted with, between the paper market and the physical market. And to me, this is just a never-ending source of frustration, but also confusion, because you'd figure at some point people would recognize that the physical demand is clearly strong and growing. So why do these traders want to position against gold? Wouldn't they eventually figure out there's more money to be made joining the trend than fighting the trend? Or am I missing what's happening here entirely? Help me, Dave, help me.
The first quarter of 2000, I actually went into a meeting with my biggest client and said, you guys have a decision to make because either the market's insane or I'm insane. And there was like nervous laughter around the room. But I said, I'm curious here. And thank God in that turn, it turned out to be the market was insane and it all ended well. But the last 10 years of zero interest rate policy, I didn't think that was possible. So here we are again. Either the market's insane or I'm insane. Maybe all of us in this room are insane. But if we're not insane, the fundamentals will always win out over the short-term market moves. Now, 10 years is something I didn't expect the market to stay irrational that long. But that's exactly what you want to say. You can't buy gold. You can't buy platinum. You can't buy these things, but the price goes down every day. That has to end well, doesn't it?
I would have thought it would have ended better by now, but it's been, like you said, it's been very long and painful.
And considering the risk reward, I don't see how anybody cannot have some commodities in their portfolio, especially gold at this point.
Let me just jump in if I can. It's Adam, since I don't think we have a video going on this. If you talk about an area that is really, really hated and unloved, gold certainly meets that criteria. And that's why, we had our gold exposure basically down at near zero back in 2020. We allocated as much to energy as we could, but we've been adding and we've been adding and we've been adding because in 2020, when I was telling people why you should be bullish of energy, no one wanted to hear it. And everyone was sort of gagging and their stomach was turning. And now I get invited onto the conference circuit to talk about oil and energy and uranium. And I've lost that sort of visceral reaction on people. And then they say, well, what do you like to buy now? I say gold stocks. And I say, oh, there it is. They start to lose their lunch all over again. And so that's where you definitely want to be. If you want to look forward in the next 5-6 years, gold stocks are the most unloved. They're the most depressed. You talk about why they haven't performed better. I think obviously, if you look at just the sheer amount of money that's been printed, gold has a strong bullish story. The last time we got to these levels was back in late 1990s. And my partner Lee had a big article in Forbes where, you know, he put a $2,500 price target on gold. Remember, gold had fallen from $800 to $275 over 20 years. It was a bold call, but it was based on how much money was outstanding versus the value of gold. And that's where, if it re-rated to the old historical highs, it should go. If you do that today, you're at $8,000 or $10,000 an ounce. So that's the people that like gold, you know, that's the type of analysis that they're doing. And then people say, well, why hasn't it acted better in the last, you know, 12, 24 months? And I think the big reason there is, you know, we went through a really aggressive rate hike cycle, and we have real rates now that are not conducive to gold. And so I think the more interesting question is why gold has held in as well as it has. And the answer there is the central banks. You know, the central banks have bought more gold in the last 12 months than at any time since gold was money. You know, it is more monetized by central banks now than it was, you know, since the 1960s. It's incredible. You have China, you have Singapore, you have Brazil, India. So something is happening. The central banks have really stepped in, and I think that's helped to absorb this real rate cycle that we've been in the last 12 months. The question is kind of where you go from here. The Western speculators are just dumping gold. If you look at the shares of the GLD, they come into the market every day and they sell gold, and the central banks are buying it. And the question is, if you turn that Western speculator and they run up against the central bank buying, that's when you start to get hundreds of dollars an ounce on gold in a short period of time. You're not there yet. What changes the mind of the Western speculator? If I did that, you know, I wouldn't be on these podcasts talking about fundamentals.
The irony, though, Adam, with that, I totally agree with that analysis. And I, like you, share my sense of being impressed about how well gold did in the face of what I never imagined the Fed would do in terms of rate hikes last year. But what I don't understand now is that there's a universal conviction that the Fed's going to pivot. And the question is just when. And they're building in, what is it, 4 rate cuts next year. And if they actually believe that, why isn't gold now moving up? You know, it withstood the pressure of the higher rates. You'd think if those rates are now going to reverse, gold should be taken off, and instead it's sold off, you know, enormously in the last couple of weeks. So that's my struggle.
I agree. I think that there's a fairly universal belief, and you know, people disagree with me, but I think this has been true throughout. There's been a universal belief so far this cycle that the Fed has this all in hand, that, you know, they're going to thread the needle. And even when you had the Wall Street Journal with inflation headlines, everyone basically believed that Powell was going to figure it out. No one, you know, you never lost the anchoring on the long end of the curve. You never really lost the tips market. You never had this inflationary psychology. And so I think that's part of it too. You know, like, yeah, people are now pricing in rate cuts next year, but that's in the view of like moderate inflation. No one thinks that inflation is coming back. And I think the biggest surprise is strong inflation in the back half of this decade.
That's manifest in the dollar strength, that conviction in the Fed, and that they're going to stick the landing for the first time in the history of the Federal Reserve. Anyway, Grant, I'm going to shut my trap now.
If I can, James, I want to come back to you if I can. Yeah, the backdrop to this whole conversation, and it's been fascinating to listen to all three of you, and I've got a ton of questions, but I want to go back to a macro one if I can first. James, you know, the macro backdrop that you laid out, I think it's almost impossible to disagree with any of that. But my question is, that setup has been the case for quite some time. We've all kind of looked down the road for probably 15 odd years now, and we've seen us heading towards this point. And it certainly feels every day like we're getting closer and closer to a moment where all of this stuff matters. You know, all the stuff that anyone that's looked at commodities, looked at money supply, looked at all these things we've discussed from a macro standpoint, where we find ourselves today has been inevitable. There was no other way, as you say, that the options available to them just don't match up. So I'm just curious as to what is it that finally triggers this? What is it that now, because I have a gut feeling that we're at a place where all of the things we've been talking about is finally going to matter, and the world we've described at the top of the show is going to manifest. But I'm curious if you have a sense of what it might be that will finally make that matter to enough people that it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cat is out of the bag, where inflation was here. It was almost double digits in the US. It broke double digits in the UK. And one thing people really need to understand is that inflation and all of these dynamics are very psychological. And now that people have seen these huge upswings in inflation, where we've been told for maybe for years and years, we want inflation, we can't get it. Now that we've seen that it can come back, and then when people see that within the context of what's going on with deficits, what's going on with unconventional monetary policy, with easing and, you know, non-conventional bailouts like we saw in the UK with LDI, we saw it in the US, both with the repo market, again, with the regional banks. You know, we're in this era of no more moral hazard for risk assets. And I think that now, psychologically, people understand that there are consequences, where for much of the era from, call it 2009 to 2019, there was this suspended belief that, okay, we can run, you know, basically 0% rates, we'll grow 2% real, we'll have 0% vol, and the S&P will grow earnings 7% a year, and it's just a, you know, happy, lovely ecosystem to invest in. That psychology, I think, is broken. I think there's a lot of reasons why you're seeing the market move the way it has this year. A lot of it is technicals. A lot of it is market structure. But I think kind of the last straw, or, you know, shoe to drop here is what happens to what are pretty aggressive earnings assumptions, especially within kind of the mega tech complex. Once that psychology breaks, then I think the focus comes back to where everybody on this call is. And then that's where I see, I think you do get a big move. And then when it moves, you know, the big institutions, you can't put hundreds of billions of dollars to work here. So the incumbents that are sitting here, you know, to Steph's point, getting bludgeoned on certain days like today, you know, we're the ones sitting here owning this stuff. And, you know, unless we're forced sellers, we're not going to be sellers and someone's going to bid this up.
This inflection point that we've all kind of talked about and looked for, to your point about inflation, the fact that it got so high and the fact that it's slowed down but it's still rising seems to be something that people kind of misinterpret. They all think inflation's gone away. It's here. It's just slightly slower. The equity market, if you look at the charts of bond market and the equity market, there's a great chart of the 10-year and the S&P 500 going around today, and another chart of stocks versus commodities, and the disconnects are so glaring now. I mean, truly, truly extraordinary, even through some of the things that we've all sat and witnessed. What do you think it takes for the equity market to crack? And I'm happy for anybody to answer that if they have a strong opinion on it, because, you know, I keep looking at it, and I understand your point about the tech complex, James, and we kind of thought that maybe 6 months ago in March when Silicon Valley fell over, we might see some of the tech complex start to wobble, and it did for a little while, but damn if they're not back again. What do you think it takes for equity investors to look at the bond market, look at the macro backdrop, and understand that, to your point earlier, Adam, the valuations are just way too high?
You know, I'll start and be very quick, is where, you know, I think that the moral hazard component is just so pervasive now that I don't think we're going to have a free fall the way that we've seen in prior types of dislocations. I think that there's this continued belief in a safety net from policy support, whether conventional or unconventional. So I think the more likely scenario is a re-rating of the companies that just don't make money. And you've seen that with a lot of profitless tech. Hope turns a floats eternal with AI and mega cap tech. But I think kind of a more likely scenario is, you know, a re-rating in the low quality businesses, which could be severe, but then kind of a grind lower to nowhere in the large area. Because again, I think that the preconditions for a free fall might not exist the way that they have in prior cycles. But, you know, would love to hear Dave and kind of Adam's view on that as well.
Sure, I can pipe in. Agreeing with all that, but to add a little more on the slow grind of the large stocks, once again, remembering the 70s and why it is that Warren Buffett was able to buy Coca-Cola for $2.50 or whatever, is because in the 70s, a very different world than what we've seen the last 40 years. You know, if you can push prices 5-6% a year and your cost of goods are going nowhere, your margins go up. But in the 1970s, if you were Coke or Kellogg's or people like that, you raised your price 5% a year and you watched the price of sugar and aluminum and cardboard and those things go up 10% a year, your margins went down. people hated these quality moat companies back when I came in the business in the early 80s because it was a different environment. If we are going back to where costs are going up, that might accentuate the slow fall of some of these big companies. People don't expect their margins to start going down again. And it should be interesting. Maybe it will be like the 70s if those, you know, the profitless tech companies, of course, are in trouble. And you know, in video, we'll see if trees can grow too high. But if the big companies are going to have profit margins and the money's going to roll in, by the end of the 70s, what, the largest market cap on earth was Schlumberger, I believe. It was an entirely different world. Maybe it won't be so much the market getting routed as just to being very volatile. And maybe this is just a dream. The money goes out of the expensive stuff into the stocks that we're all talking about today.
I share that dream. I mean, just to underscore your point, though, Dave, the forecast, the consensus estimate for earnings next year is 12.6% growth. And the consumer discretionary expectations are higher than that. So where that margin, you know, expansion is going to come from escapes me, because it's pretty clear consumers are spent up and lent up. And you guys, all three of you, have outlined very compelling cases for higher input costs, substantially higher input costs that are going to stay higher for a long time. So that, you know, those input cost pressures are not going to go away at a time when they don't have much ability to pass them on, as near as I can tell. Adam, do you have any thoughts on this conversation about the inflation phenomenon and why these valuations are so stretched in the equity market?
Yeah, I do actually. So, you know, I think there's two sort of interesting things, one from a straight valuation perspective, and then one from how inflationary expectations are actually impairing companies, you know, abilities to operate and things like that. And neither of them are properly understood. Maybe the first is a little bit better. But obviously, you know, you have these companies with high valuation still, you know, you have, like you said, NVIDIA growing to the sky and things of that nature. And typically when we get these periods of easy money and these periods of ample credit creation, you see this huge bull market in these abstractions, and you know, several of the books going back, looking at financial history, do wonderful jobs of talking just about how bizarre and abstract things get. You know, you have time and time again through these massive, massive bubbles and bull markets in history, you'll have basically the equivalent of SPACs. You'll have the idea that things, you know, 20, 30, 50 years in the future are just as valuable as something today. And that's really, as much as anything else, what happens when you reset inflationary expectations. You bring multiples down in these high growth, high multiple stocks, and you make something, you know, worth much more today than something 20 and 30 years out. And in that pendulum swing, that's when it seems as though, you know, the widget maker does well and the tech companies do poorly. But really what you're doing is you're pulling the value of some of those cash flows closer to today and away from the future. And so, you know, what is it that ultimately triggers that flow of capital back into value, back into real assets? It's tough to say, but we kind of all know, looking at these sort of Minsky moments and looking at these, you know, periods of bubbles pricking and moving back, that's going to be, you know, it's going to be in that department. But the other thing that I think is really important and is really misunderstood is just what an unbelievable impact 10 years of cheap energy and cheap capital has brought to the economy. And it has led to huge distortions of capital, huge malinvestment. And there was a great, you know, back what it's in it, following the Mississippi bubble, there was a company that was floated and listed that was looking to ship ice skates to Brazil. And that was, you know, always the poster child of dumb business ideas, because of course there were no ice rinks in Brazil. And I wonder if solar panels in Germany, where there's no sunshine, will be our version of ice skates to Brazil. And it's been entirely a function of free capital and really cheap energy. So things that have been energy intensive and things that have been capital intensive have been allowed to proliferate. And we're seeing the severity at which that is now becoming undone. And, you know, you look at Ørsted over the last few weeks and, you know, they're impairing project after project, and they're going to walk away from several offshore U.S. Wind facilities, notably. But this is just the start. There's been all kinds of business models that have been built on cheap energy and cheap money. And so I think you'll get it from valuations, in which case you'll have kind of the virtuous circle working against you in reverse. But it'll also work against you in fundamentals, in the sense, is your business model set up dependent on cheap money and cheap energy? Because those have been at, you know, the cheapest levels we've seen, say, Six Sigma, whatever, in human history in the last decade together. And that's now in the process of unwinding. So what does that mean to the underlying business models? I think is less well understood.
Doesn't that describe crypto?
I think it does. I think it really, really does.
Just saying.
James might not agree.
Dave, let me ask you, and Ed, I'm curious to get your input on this as well. From a kind of a practical standpoint, there are people who are buying into the commodity narrative. They look at all the things we've talked about and they can see that there's a really strong case to own commodities now. But trading and trying to own commodities at the right point in the cycle is an incredibly difficult thing to do if you're not a commodity specialist, you know, because the cycles are so painful to go through, and everything we've discussed speaks as to that point, and they're not doing what they should do, and they don't tend to do that for a long, long time before they really take off. So from a practical standpoint, help people understand the right way to go about positioning and position sizing and mentally handling investing at the early stages of a commodity bull market, because it's really easy to get kind of thrown off the horse. Dave, I can come to you first, and then Adam, maybe you could chip in as well. That'd be great.
There's maybe lots of right ways. We don't pretend to have the right way, but an approach that works for us. Commodities may be boring, but boring can be good. In this world of AI and disintermediation and great businesses becoming obsolete overnight, a lot of commodities aren't in that camp, but it'll take a lot of change to make it to where people don't need copper. Maybe someday we're off hydrocarbons, but not in my lifetime. If things are useful and needed and scarce, that's a good start. Then things like lithium are tougher because the bull argument's good, but the bear argument's there too. And so it's up to each bill. But yeah, to us, copper and nickel and gold is money, and gas and oil are all things that make sense to us. Then the second thing we do is look at what we call the incentive price, you know, equilibrium price. So if the current price is allowing people to make a lot of money and they're plowing that back into new supply, then one can worry about whether the price is too high and whether the cycle is going to end. But if prices are below that incentive price, if people, they might make money on existing mines, but can they make money on an incremental mine or well? If they cannot, that makes us feel a little better. So we'll talk to people about what they see the prices is. More importantly, we will look at their actions. If people are bringing on, if they're drilling lots of oil wells or they're building tons of nickel mines, then we can worry. If you're not seeing that, we feel pretty comfortable. So buy a commodity that's cheap, selling below its cost of production, no supply coming in, and buy the stock for cheaper than the metal's worth. That allows us to sit tight when things temporarily look bad, because, you know, eventually, if I'm right about those fundamentals, the price must go higher.
Yeah, I think that's all very well said. And in fact, you know, we like to look at a lot of the similar features, like a long-term equilibrium price and things of that nature. But one thing that I think has to be really well understood in the commodities and natural resource markets is that they're volatile markets. And I think that a lot of people try desperately to try to make them something they're not, and to try to reduce that volatility. And either they can do that by staying out of the resource markets altogether. That tends to be what people do at the bottom. They can try to time it, which some people are really good market timers and other people are not. We're not particularly good market timers. And then the third is to try to hedge it. And they either hedge it through equity long short strategies, of which we actually managed one for 10 years, to and know all the pros and cons to that, or private equity where you just spread the marks out over the years and say, look, it's not so volatile as all. Our approach is a little bit different. I think you just have to appreciate it's a volatile space, and it's volatile because your top line is extremely volatile. You know, the commodity markets from $130 oil down to minus 47, you were talking about a surplus to a deficit of plus or minus less than a million barrels a day on a 101 million barrel a day market, right? So everything on the margin has these huge amplified effects in the commodity, and it's a volatile space. So instead of that, I think what people need to do to get their arms around it is realize it's volatile, understand that it's also not really correlated to other parts of the market. And so there's a benefit to it. Now, you can take, in my mind, one of two approaches. One is to set it and forget it and realize that you have natural resources which are less than correlated to equities, and you kind of plug them in at 5% and you just leave them there. And I promise you, over any full cycle, you'll be happy that you did so, because they'll work when other things don't. Or you try to be a little bit more tactical. And if you want to be more tactical, what you should look for is periods where you have underinvested in supply. And that, to us, is the most predictive indicator for a really strong resource, commodity and resource stock bull market. You know, 1929, you hit a period of time where commodities were so cheap relative to the broad market that if you bought a basket of commodity stocks right at the market high before the Depression, you know, what are perceived to be these very economically sensitive oil and copper stocks, 10 years on, that portfolio had doubled. The broad market was still down 50% and the price level was off still about 35%. So they were volatile during that period, for sure. There's no two ways about it, right? And if you were weak hands, I'm sure you got shaken out. But if you bought and held when commodities were super cheap relative to the broad market, when the weightings were very, very low against their historical levels, it helped to protect you over almost anything that happened in the next 10 or 15 years. That was true during the inflationary 1970s, during the huge deflationary 1930s, and during the, you know, just very turbulent but ultimately sideways market of 99 to 2010, right? You had three recessions. You had, you know, the Y2K, the 9/11, and the GFC, major market pullbacks and the whole bit. And the best place to be, again, these economically sensitive commodity stocks. So that bodes well for where we are today. So my two, you know, preferred ways to kind of explain the space to people is to just say, look, you know, I think it really should be a permanent asset allocation. Don't try to time it. That's my own bias talking, because I'm not a great market timer. And if you do want to get tactical, look for periods of time where it's super cheap relative to the broad market. And that happens to be right now.
Fantastic. That's really helpful. Dave, can I come back to you? Something else you said there that I'm curious to get a little bit more color on. And that's this idea of flipping the DCF model, which I haven't heard people talk about, and it's got my head spinning. So perhaps you could just give us a sense of what happens in the commodity space when you do flip that model, to help people understand what a difference that makes.
Yeah, it is really interesting to me, because I've been talking to people about this for a couple of years, and not a single person has told me I'm wrong, but nobody's changing what they're doing. Yeah, it's interesting to go to these, you know, I'm talking buy side, sell side, the companies themselves. You know, you go to these conferences and say, why, you know, do you like the dollar? No, I hate the dollar. I like gold. Well, what gold companies are you buying? Well, we're buying the ones that turn gold back into dollars as fast as possible. And I'm like, no, you've got it backwards. And so I don't know. I'm waiting for somebody to tell me where I'm wrong on this process. But until they do, I think we're onto something. I think that the market is putting the lowest price on the things that are the most valuable.
They seem to do that for long stretches of time, frequently.
I mean, even when you speak to management teams and investment banks that are promoting these management teams, they're still using that same backwards framework. That so it's almost like, because people have used it incorrectly for as long as they have, people just accept it as the right way to do it industry-wide. And so any deviation to just using a PV10 at strip with these really high discount rates and, like, backwardated assumptions is just, you know, heresy, when there's no pragmatism in thinking about how to value anything within these sub industries that we're talking about today. So, you know, I think that what Dave's really getting at is that there's an enormous opportunity for evaluation reversion in the space under static pricing, whereas the rest of the market has these really ambitious multiples where I would argue there's very little potential for any type of multiple expansion. Whereas even under the status quo of energy, of gold, of uranium, of copper, a simple reversion to a reasonable multiple of these companies will generate a more than satisfactory real rate of return.
Regarding the second part of your question, I think I didn't answer that. I got this chart I can send you. I love it. Nobody else around here likes it. But it basically shows over 20 years, if you say, all right, I've got a gold coin, what's it worth? I bury it in the ground. And 1 year, 2 years, up to 20 years, what's the value of that over 20 years? The DCF, I think it loses over 70% of its value at a 5% discount rate. a Black Scholes with, I can't remember, 10% volatility or whatever, the value increases sevenfold. So 700% up versus 70% loss is the difference between those two models. We can argue which model's better. The truth may be somewhere in between, but you can drive a truck through that.
The mirror image of this, which I think is fascinating, is our deficit accounting math, which, at James, as you said at the top, assumes no recession and no real runaway inflation or anything like that. And also the pension math, which in the inverse of what you're talking about here, Dave, assumes 8% returns infinitely into the future when an 8% return doesn't even exist today. So, I mean, it's the exact flip side of that. But anyway, we should probably try to tie this up a little bit. We've been going for a while here. Should we see if there's one more question?
I'm going to hog one more question if I can, and then perhaps we'll let you guys either sum up or ask a question of one of the others, if that'd be okay. But Adam, just coming back to something you kind of threw in casually, and it's a subject that's drawn so much debate in the last few months, and that's BRICS. You mentioned the BRICS and how important it is to watch what the BRICS are doing. And firstly, I couldn't agree more, but there's just an entrenched position on both sides of this. People are either saying that BRICS are completely irrelevant, or they're going to come up with a new gold-backed currency that's going to end the dollar tomorrow. It's one of the two, and there's nothing in the middle. So from your more pragmatic view about talking about watching what they're doing, what's your assessment of what's happening vis-a-vis the BRICS and either a currency or less reliance on the dollar?
No, it is a very polarizing question, and I think if everyone admitted to themselves what they know and don't know, everyone would say, we have no idea. But one thing that is changing right now is the way people are beginning to settle bilateral commodity trades. And the reason that that is so important is that if you go back, and there's been no shortage of people that have been talking about the demise of the US dollar as a reserve currency, and they've been saying that for, I don't know, probably longer, but certainly at least 20 years that I've been reading them. They probably, I presume there must have been a huge number that when the US dollar went off gold in 1968-71 must have been calling for the end of the US dollar as a reserve currency then too. But in any event, you know, since certainly the early 2000s, the argument has been large and widening deficits. The argument has been political gridlock. And in recent years, you know, a retrenchment from projecting power on a global geopolitical basis, you know, probably culminating with the withdrawal from Afghanistan earlier in 2022. So, you know, you could make the case at any point in the last 20 years that the conditions for the reserve currency status of the US dollar are becoming less and less and less. The problem was you weren't seeing any evidence of that anywhere. And the classic example that people use is that when Australia sold coal to China, they did it in US dollars. Obviously, they didn't have to. They could have done it in renminbi or Aussie dollars or any other currency, but it was done in US dollars. Why? Because that was 100% of global international commodity trade was settled in US dollars. Several things have happened in the last 12 months. Not necessarily changes to all those preconditions for why the US dollar could lose its reserve currency throne, but rather examples of how it is currently happening now. You have Brazil settling both iron ore and soybean trades, or proposed to, in renminbi. You have even what I think is one of the most fascinating ones is Total has agreed to sell LNG to China, settled in renminbi. So, you know, that's not Brazil. It's not India. It's not a stated, it's a private company, French to boot. So you're starting to see now the beginnings of a change in how we operate on a global basis. And part of that is deficits. Part of that is what we saw to the treasury markets a couple of years ago. Because remember, you would recycle all those excess dollars back into treasuries, the volatility there. Part of it is weaponizing the US dollar system, which we've seen several times. So all of these contribute, but the whys almost aren't important. What's important is that we're seeing examples of that changing now. So then you have to say to yourself, okay, fine, if there's going to be a pendulum swinging towards more commodity trade settlement outside of the US dollar, how does that work? Because there's not a clear replacement to the dollar as a reserve currency. That's the other thing we hear all the time. You know, it's the best house on a bad block. What are you going to own as a reserve currency if not the dollar? And it looks as though it's trying to be the renminbi. And the renminbi is a terrible reserve currency, mostly because it's a closed capital system. And so you can't repatriate those renminbi back, you know, in the international monetary exchange system. So what do you do? And it seems as though our best guess, and we read all the same people that I'm sure you all do. We read Zoltan, we read Louis and Charles Gav, we read Forest for the Trees, all these different things. What it seems as though the most likely system may or may not be would be one where you trade, you'll take Brazil, for example. Brazil sells a whole bunch of iron ore and soybeans to China. They get a ton of renminbi back. They can't use their renminbi to buy a townhouse in Belgravia. So what they do is they try to buy as many cheap Chinese goods as they can. And with the imbalance that remains, they settle that via the Shanghai Gold Exchange in gold. And so people say, well, is that a gold standard? Not really. In fact, it's quite the opposite, right? A gold standard has gold as the center of value and fiat currencies as these proxies and slips of paper that you switch back and forth. This has a fiat currency, in fact, a highly managed fiat currency at the center holding value. And then gold is used to kind of transact on the margin and settle imbalances. So it does represent a world where gold is more monetized or remonetized. It has a monetary role more than it does today, but by no means is a gold standard or anything like that. Is this going to happen? We have absolutely no idea, but we are seeing more and more commodity settlement that is being done now outside of the dollar. And as I pointed out at the top of this interview, every time real assets in the past have gotten so out of whack with financial assets, it has tended to coincide with some shift, sometimes big, sometimes small, in how we conduct the global monetary plumbing system of the world. Is that a necessary condition? No. Is it, you know, scientific proof? No, but we operate, you know, in the dismal sciences and things like that. And so it's something that we have noticed over and over again. And I think it could be beginning to happen right now. So we'll have to wait and see. All of these BRICS countries have been buying a ton of gold, tons, I suppose, literally of gold, more than any time in the last 30 years. But on the flip side, not to talk out of both sides of my mouth here, you know, everyone was waiting for this BRICS meeting earlier this year to be this huge announcement. And clearly that did not take place. And so maybe things will happen more slowly or more quietly, or maybe not at all. It's just, I think, a tail risk that people should be more aware of than they have been in the past. How's that for tempered?
Perfect. That's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you. A balanced opinion, finally. Well, look, why don't we wrap this up? And let me start again with you, James, and either sum up your thoughts on the conversation, or if you have any questions that you'd like to ask any other folks on the call, then feel free to choose one of those paths or a path completely independent of those two.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do 50-50. So I think to summarize my thoughts is it seems almost obvious to us the benefits of owning real assets, whatever modality. You know, all three of us, I think, have great modalities for expressing this view and exactly what you want to own for this kind of new world that we all envision. What I, you know, struggle with is that investors all seem to appreciate the nuance and what we're talking about and why. I just struggle with, you know, when does the mainstream kind of adopt to the fact that what's fairly obvious is you can't continue to own and bet on the same things that have existed for 30 years. And so I guess the question, which could segue into kind of their concluding remarks, is, you know, what do you think it will take, not so much for the broader market to kind of give back or, you know, normalize, but when I started in this business in the early 2000s, people loved bricks, people loved natural resources, people loved real estate, infrastructure. And we've gone so far on the other side. You know, so maybe Dave, who's had way more experience with market cycles than me, like, what is it going to take to actually see people care about what we've all been yapping to each other about for what seems like forever?
Yeah, I wonder if we're in the same order or whether I pipe in now. So I'll pipe in now. And my question back to Horizon has done such great work on the indexes and the fallacies. The inverse of your question to me on gold and why is that going up? You know, when is this indexation craze gonna end? But to answer the question, my final summary, I think most of the commodity stocks right now are so cheap that if everything you've heard for the last hour and a half is wrong, I think you still make money. If there's any truth to what we're saying on the fundamentals, you can make a lot of money, probably in the commodities, even more so in the stocks, as I've suggested, even more so on the highly optionality ones. Bricks were thrown into it. If commodities aren't liked in emerging markets, are really hated. We've done pretty well, say, owning Ivanhoe in the Congo or Kazakhstan and Kazatomprom. We don't own YPF, which we did up 7 times in the last year and a half. Maybe money's starting to migrate back into commodities and emerging markets. As far as the question to me on timing, I've been around too long to think I have a clue, but as I mentioned earlier, the math is pretty good. 8 or 9 years ago, everybody said, what's your favorite idea? I said, uranium, and looked like an idiot for 6 years. And then in 1 year, we had 2 stocks went up tenfold in a year from the bottom to the top. I think on average, we're probably up 5x. We show people these IRR charts and saying, all right, we know DCF, let's flip it upside down. If we're going to make 2, 3, 4 times our money, what's our return if it takes 2 years, 4 years, 6, 8? And the math is pretty good, even if you have to wait. And I think commodities are that undervalued. I think the math works even if you have to wait. If we're right on the fundamentals, you won't have to wait.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, we get a lot of questions in this, again, commodities to financial assets. There's a period from basically 1955, when commodities first get cheap, to 1969, they kind of just trough and trend lower. And people said, aha, I gotcha. What if we're in that period and we have to sit and wait 15 years? But of course, that's relative to the broad market. And in fact, you know, you did pretty well in both. And I think we're kind of in that market, in that world again now, where these things are so cheap that, you know, even if they kind of move quote unquote sideways relative to financial assets, they'll still go up. And in fact, I think they're going to re-rate much, much, much higher. I think one thing though that is really unique, you know, it's different, so use a synonym for different, this time is unique, would be that the contortions and the backflips that people have gotten themselves tied into with this ESG stuff. And I think, you know, on Wall Street, it was the closest thing we'd ever had to a free lunch, because for the last 6 or 7 years, you could sign the UN pledge and you could talk about how you were going to be really mindful of ESG. And you kind of got 200 basis points of tailwind by not having owned any oil stocks. And it wasn't an investment allocation decision anymore. It was, you know, your pledge to not destroy the whole planet. So it worked until it doesn't. But now these guys find themselves in this unbelievable, tough spot, including, you know, Mr. Fink, who's had to say recently, you know, that he feels that the words ESG have become somewhat weaponized. You say, yeah, you think you had whole industries that were liquidated because of, you know, your rhetoric. So, you know, now you have these asset allocators that are taking longer. They have to kind of untie some of those Gordian knots that they find themselves in before they can even really look at the space. And, you know, that's preventing, I think, the fundamentals from having the response in the market. You know, typically 3 years into a bull market like this, with inventories falling across the board, you should have started to, and sector leadership, you should have started to see some money come back in, and you're not this time. And the only thing that I can really point to, and when I talk to asset allocators, they back it up, is that they really can't, you know, and soon that'll change. It'll change either because you'll have an emergency meeting and it'll be the only way that your pension fund is able to meet its target. It was by having an oil stock. So you'll change the rules, or you'll fire the old guys, or they'll all retire, whatever the case may be. The result is that I think for the first time in a while, these shortages are just going to have to hit us over the head. I don't think we have the wherewithal to look through this and understand what needs to be done and get the capital into the right place. You'd still have a bull market, but you'd avert a bit of a crisis and a catastrophe. It strikes me more now like we're going to have to actually run up into that. And, you know, all you have to do is look at what happened in Germany last year. Russia invaded the Ukraine. 20 years of well-laid plans for greening and renewables went out the window almost immediately. They burned more coal than ever. Turns out that a mild winter, and now everyone is just like so complacent again. So it's like in 16 months, you threw out the entire old energy policy, thank goodness. You then did a 180-degree turn on that, and now you just are sort of treading water, not knowing what to do. So we're not, we haven't allowed ourselves the intellectual honesty to really assess this problem. And I think a big part of that is because of this ESG debate. And so the problems will have to come and hit us over the head, and that's going to be very uncomfortable, but ultimately probably good for these stocks.
Sorry, Grant, this is too tempting here.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is too tempting to wrap up between Dave's point, where he tossed it back to me on indexation, and then Adam bringing up the fallacies of ESG. So ESG arose right at the point when vanilla indexation was moderating and stopping to grow, and everybody cut fees as close to zero as they possibly could. What did ESG represent? It represented a way to basically own the same passive index and charge a boatload more fees to then index to ESG. So maybe I'm answering my own question about when this thing all turns, is that it seems as though the indexation game in the US has played itself out. There's no more margin. There's almost no more market share to be had. They tried it with this ESG scheme. That's unwinding before our eyes. So maybe this is the perfect setup to finally actually see all the pieces line up to actually get allocations here again.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a great point. We've gone for an hour and a half and taken a big chunk out of your afternoon. So I'm immensely grateful to all three of you for taking the time to join us and have this conversation, because I think it's an important conversation to have. And I suspect everything we've talked about will play out in the fullness of time. You know, there are periods in this commodity cycle where the fullness of time seems like an age, but I suspect we are at a much closer to an inflection point than we have been at any point in the last kind of 10 years. So again, thank you for doing that. If I can just get you quickly to let people listening know where they can find out more about your writing and websites and stuff, I'll go around the table again. James, starting with you, if I may.
Sure. And again, thanks to everyone else here, Adam, Dave, Steph, Grant. This has been really fun and really informative. Horizon Kinetics, we're fairly prolific in our writing. We're very generous with our commentaries, our white papers. Also on our Horizon Kinetics Twitter, we have some musings, which I think are very consistent and factual in alignment with a lot of the things discussed today. And always you can just reach out to me or anyone at Horizon. We love to speak to like-minded investors, clients, and all the above.
Fantastic. Adam?
Yeah, for better or worse, we publish everything that we write as well, and we leave up all our old calls and just like the folks at Horizon do, and you can see where we got things right and where we got things wrong. And so please check out our website. We're at gorosen.com. The firm, of course, is Gehring and Rosenzweig. That's where Go Rosen comes from. And luckily, if you get it half right on Google, it'll point you in the right direction.
Yeah, that's a spelling test if ever there were one.
That's right. And Dave.
Okay. No, I agree. Thanks to all four of you. This has been a lot of fun, very interesting and informative. We also write a fair amount and have videos and other things to, in these interesting times, communication's important. Our website, CopernicGlobal.com.
Fantastic. Well, again, thanks to all of you for giving up your time. The last word, as always, will go to Steph once you've all resumed your days. But thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. This is great.
Thanks.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Well, Steph, thank you for coming up with this idea and doing most of the heavy lifting to put it all together. That was hugely, hugely interesting. I loved every second of that.
It really was. And honestly, I could have gone on longer and longer listening to them talk about, I mean, the ideas were really interesting, not necessarily what I expected, but also the macro backdrop. I mean, there's just so much there and it's so contrarian, yeah. I think, right yeah. now.
No, I mean, I'm frankly amazed that it's still counts as contrarian, frankly. Yeah. You would think it makes so much sense. And I'm going to try and get that chart from Dave to put in the transcript because I really want to see that.
I loved his line. Even if I'm totally wrong, you're still going to do
right,
well.
Right, exactly right. Exactly right. Well, look, I mean, it was so much fun. We should probably try and do it again in several months' time and see.
Well, let's see how things are going. Now we're not anywhere in the same time zone, but at least the time zone difference is... Or is it? It's a little better.
It's manageable. It's slightly I'll better. Be back in your sort of time zone pretty soon. So it'll make life much easier. Well, listen.
Okay.
Thank you. Before we go, just a quick reminder on those websites. Dave Ivan Kopenick Global is kopenickglobal.com. That's K's instead of C's, wherever you hear a K sound. Go Rosen for Adam Rosenzweig and Lee Goering is G O R O Z E N. See, I defaulted to Z's instead of Z's there.
It's G O R O S. Like Sammy and
I think you're wrong. Hang on. I think you're wrong.
We're going to double check. I just looked.
All right. Let's have a little friendly wager here. $1. What do you reckon?
Oh, I typed in Go Rosen with an S and it picked it up, but it does. You're right. I'm sorry. All right. See, this is why you have to do the heavy lifting.
Give me $1. So that's Go Rosen, G-O-R-O-Z-E-N. And James DeVolos, of course, horizonkinetics.com. As all gentlemen said, they put a lot of their writing up there and it's really, really helpful and it's fascinating stuff. So I would encourage you all, if you don't already dig into the writings of all three gentlemen, you will find a treasure trove of stuff and three new people to follow as this whole commodities bull market unfolds. The other person, obviously, we have to talk about finding on the internet is one Stephanie Pomboy at macromavens.com.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, and on Twitter, are you still on Twitter? Or X? What do we call it now?
At X, exactly, at S Pomboy.
At S
and
Pomboy.
You,
and I
Mr.
remain,
Grant David Vincent Williams.
For the time being, at TTMYGH. I'm not sure how much of X I can stand, to be honest with you, but we'll keep going for the time being. It's getting more and more painful by the day. Steph, it's been far too long since I've seen that beautiful smile of yours. I'm so happy to see it again. And hopefully we can do another one of these sooner rather than later. What do you think?
Yeah, I look forward to that. That would be really fun to do.
All right. Well, look after yourself. But stay away from all the snakes infesting South Florida.
Yeah, I'm going to try to avoid the pythons.
Yeah, stay away from the pythons.
Only at Saks.
Yeah, okay. I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Take care. Hip, hip, and cheerio.
Nothing we discuss during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.